W91.7 and KRW.org.
Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Especially in Silicon Valley, the intersection of productivity and a Bay Area culture that's known for searching for alternative approaches, that's making some people try experimenting with small doses of psychedelics, LSD or psilocybin mushrooms, commonly known as magic mushrooms, as a potential aid for everything from productivity to creativity, empathy, even amelioration of depression. Well, but what do we know and don't know about what's called microdosing in general, but especially pertaining to the workplace? After all, that's what the show's supposed to be about. And with us to explore the issue is an advocate, Paul Austin, who runs a website called The Third Wave. His bio there says that in 2015, he began his first microdosing protocol, and he says that he continues to use psychedelics. Paul is, quote, committed to changing the cultural conversation about psychedelics, end quote, and he has been featured in Rolling Stone and cited in the New York Times and Playboy. He's also the author of a new book, Microdosing Psychedelics. Paul Austin, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hey, Marty, thanks so much for having me on here.
My pleasure. And offering a more cautious perspective is Matt Johnson. He is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He conducts research on the behavioral and psychological effects of hallucinogens, including psilocybin, mushrooms, and as well as stimulants such as cocaine, methamphetamine, and caffeine, my favorite drug of choice. He's also been interviewed in major media, including CNN, NPR, and the New York Times. Matt Johnson, welcome to you as well.
Hey, Marty, thank you.
Great. Well, Paul Austin, let's start with you. Who, if anyone, would you recommend at this point experimenting with microdoses of acid, LSD, or psilocybin mushrooms as a way to enhance one's work life?
So the people who we see this, who we see doing this most often, microdosing in the workplace, are people who have more creative jobs where they need to access what we call a flow state and do more conceptual thinking. So we see this with a lot of engineers, developers, CEOs, people who are often looking for innovative new conceptual solutions and are looking at microdosing as a tool to help facilitate that level of creativity and sometimes focus, particularly when we're talking about these flow states.
Paul, I noted with care you said they do this to intend to do this. What is the? I know there is not yet good data on microdosing other than the anecdotes, but anecdotally, have you heard much about the extent to which their goals have been fulfilled through the use of microdoses?
I think with a lot of people, there seems to be a correlation that they're tied to microdosing as part of a larger routine that helps facilitate creativity. So they see that as being one tool in the larger toolkit. But for me, you know, I haven't heard any explicit stories of I set this objective and, you know, microdosing was the one thing that helped me to get there. It seems to be more of a general enhancer, but not necessarily tied to direct causation.
And Paul, because you yourself, both on your website and in our conversation, said that you've been microdosing for a few years now. What, especially as pertains to your work productivity, or your work, the nature of your work, the work you do, whatever, something to do with work, what, if any, changes can you causally attribute to your taking of psychedelics?
So for me, the formation of two companies, two ideas that are gaining a lot of mainstream traction. One is The Third Wave, the nonprofit that we set up that is generating about 600,000 views a month, and I directly contribute the success of that website to this, as well as a retreat center that we started in Amsterdam around psilocybin, where we're gaining investment to legally work with people with psilocybin. I'd also attribute that and the success of that project so far to my work with microdosing.
And Matthew Johnson, as you were listening to Paul answer those questions, what was going through your mind?
There's a lot of excitement around microdosing, and I think there's good reason to be scientifically interested for creativity, as Paul was talking about, learning, a treatment for depression. I think, you know, they're tinkering with systems that there's every reason to believe that's a plausible mechanism to look at. But you already alluded to one of the concerns, Marty, is there's no data yet, so to be clear on that. And there are risks, so we just have to be aware of that.
Well, let's talk about something you added to the discussion before we get to the risks. You added the depression. What is the anecdotal evidence at this point, if any, for microdosing as a tool for addressing depression? Matt.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of individuals that claim that they've tried, the library of SSRIs, et cetera, antidepressants, nothing worked for them the way that microdosing did. So, you know, they sounded like very genuine, credible folks. Of course, you never really know until you test these things under blind conditions with placebo control, et cetera. But, and as I said before, it's tinkering with the neuropharmacological mechanisms that one might expect to have an effect on something like depression.
You talked of course, but in some ways it's like a bludgeon, isn't it? Like it's so profound in its effect that it's affecting, no drug affects one system, it affects many systems. And I guess that brings us to the thing you say we need to keep in mind, risks. Now again, in the absence of good studies, we have no idea about the actual nature of the risk, but given the anecdotal evidence regarding microdosing, Matt, what should we consider? If someone is listening to this show and thinking, you know, I wouldn't mind enhancing my creativity, and I'm a CEO, I'd like to be, or I'm a software engineer and I'm not creative enough, what are the risks that such a person should keep in mind, fully acknowledging that we're talking about anecdotal evidence?
Sure. Well, I've talked to a number of folks that, accidentally took too much. You know, they're looking to microdose. You know, and next thing you know, they're behind their, you know, office desk and the walls are melting. So, especially depending on the nature of your job, if you're behind the wheel of a vehicle, et cetera, that's a problem. It may even be a problem if you're behind, your computer monitor at your desk. So that's one risk. Another one is, just to keep in mind, everything we know about the risk safety profile of psychedelics is really based on this moderate to large dose, which tends to be a very occasional thing, even in enthusiasts. So we really don't know what the effects of taking every few days for years is.
Okay. Now, before I turn it back to you, Paul, you raised the issue of dosing. You know, you said somebody could inadvertently take a lot more or a lot less than they think they're getting. How significant is, is that risk? Well, we're talking about micrograms here, I'm assuming. So how likely is it they're taking, the difference between 10 micrograms and 1 gram is less than 1/28th of an ounce. So how big a risk is the issue of, taking what you think you're taking in terms of the quantity? Matt?
It's a big risk. I mean, you're talking about amounts that you cannot measure them with their weight. And as Paul knows, the folks that are doing this in the more credible way are using to get it in a solution at a constant equilibrium, and then they take a certain volume out of that liquid. So, it's not rocket science, but, it's a little more advanced than cutting up, the tab of acid into, 10 pieces, which a lot of people do it that way. And, of course, this is all assuming the dose of the original source, which you almost never know from the illicit market.
So, Paul, as you're listening to this, regarding the issue both of dealing with depression and the overdose risk, et cetera, what's your reaction as you're listening to Matt?
Yeah, I think, Matt's right on with all of the concerns, and I think that brings up the necessity of education, the necessity of, if people are going to do this, this isn't something that you just do willy-nilly, but that you really do some serious research into beforehand. And that's why we've created a lot of the educational resources that are completely free on our website, so that if people are going to do this, that they can mitigate a lot of those risks by doing something like Matt talked about, volumetric dosing, by ensuring that if they're, for example, getting LSD, that they make sure that they test the substance first. So this is where education plays a critical role, and that's not only in microdoses, that's also obviously in higher doses, because psychedelics tend to be, quite risky generally. And so that's why it's really important that education is a critical element of anyone's journey when working with these.
So you mentioned the macro doses. Obviously, as Matt said, I think really wisely, there we can't generalize too much for the very occasional use of a macro dose, say at 1 gram of LSD, as to very frequent use of 10 micrograms of it. But do we know, given the we do have, you know, 50 years since Timothy Leary days, we have 50 years of data on large dose. How big is the risk? You know, Paul used the word risks. We know that it's a risky drug. What do we know at the macro dose about the risks and rewards that might be generalizable or might not to the micro dose, Matt?
Two big concerns with at the psychiatric level. There's probably 2% of the population with a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia or a predisposition for it. They shouldn't be exposed to these compounds. It could make those disorders worse. And then for anybody, if they have a too strong of an effect, they can have a panic reaction, what people call a bad trip. Mm-hmm. And that typically does not result in harm, even in the wild, so to speak, but sometimes it does, you know, running into traffic, again, relatively rare, but it happens, falling from heights, some of the horror stories that were probably overplayed in the late 60s. And it mildly elevates blood pressure and heart rate, even at the macro dose. But certain compounds like LSD and psilocybin do have effects on serotonin 2B receptor, which has been associated with some heart valve problems. Mm-hmm. Like fenfluramine was pulled off the market because of a mechanism there. So we don't know. You know, we may not have seen risks there for these other drugs because people take LSD and psilocybin so infrequently. So if you start taking it a couple times a week for years, who knows?
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We're talking about the use of microdoses of LSD, as well as we've been kind of focusing on LSD, but we're going to also address the peyote, the mescaline, the magic mushroom kind of the psilocybin issue. I'm talking with two experts. Neither is, you know, a super conservative person on this issue, but one is more of an advocate. He's named Paul Austin. He runs a website called Third Wave that gets hundreds of thousands of hits all the time, and he's author of a new book called Microdosing Psychedelics. And I'm talking with Matt Johnson as well, who's a little more cautious, who is associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at Johns Hopkins. So let's talk a little bit about the differences. We know, again, acknowledging that they're anecdotal, about microdosing of acid versus the so-called magic mushrooms. What do we know about the risk-reward profile differences there? Whoever wants to answer it can take a shot at it first.
Well, I think with the difference between microdoses and higher doses, higher doses tend to be a bit more chaotic in nature. So
I'm talking about mushrooms versus LSD at the microdose level.
At the microdose level. So LSD is slightly more dopaminergic, meaning that it'll likely contribute to more energy, whereas psilocybin tends to just be a bit more calmer. Psilocybin only lasts for about 6 hours, whereas LSD can last as long as 12 hours. Mm. And so that's also something to be aware of is, for example, when I first moved to New York, I was microdosing with LSD, and it contributed to enhanced levels of anxiety because there was too much there. So I switched to mushrooms as an alternative, and that has proved to be useful. So that's something to be mindful of in the differences, at least at microdose.
Yeah. Matt, you know, you've studied marijuana, you've studied caffeine, you've studied psilocybin mushrooms, you also know about LSD. How do the benefit risk profiles vary across all of those substances?
Well, the classic psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin are much safer in certain respects than so many of those others. The biggie is addiction. You just don't get hooked on this stuff.
Hmm.
You know, if you're talking about macro doses, it's usually a conversation about folks having to build up their courage to do that next dose, you know. But those risks that are already explained are there for you know, the classic psychedelic, the bad trip, and people that may have a psychotic predisposition. So it's just a different nature. They're kind of like, you know, which one of these doesn't belong in the drug world? You know, they don't, you know, they have their own risks, but they're different in nature. They're not, they don't lend themselves to self-control problems.
So in other words, you know, and I think about I know a fair amount about alcohol and marijuana, and I do know something about caffeine. I know nothing about psilocybin and about LSD. But I know, for example, that caffeine is supposed to be awesome for you in many ways, unless you have high blood pressure. You know, it does increase, it increases your IQ, your focus, your energy, your brain power. So, you know, with salutary effects in terms of decreased risks of cancer, diabetes, etc. So, isn't that an awesome risk reward rate? And marijuana, I did a review of marijuana pros and cons for Time Magazine, where I reviewed really the authoritative studies, and there really are risks of significant psychological damage and cardiovascular damage in marijuana. And I like marijuana myself; it feels great. But it seems like caffeine is like this awesome drug. Marijuana's got this kind of mixed bag, short-term benefits and long-term, really pretty significant problems, memory and IQ stuff. And aren't there really very, very, can a case be made that really that caffeine is the drug of choice when you weigh all of the risk-reward ratios of all these things in the workplace?
Well, it's certainly my substance of choice. but I would be a little more skeptical of that. I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
I mean, that even though it's not, it should be your caffeine consumption should be the first thing that any physician asks about if you come about anxiety problems mm-hmm. or about trouble sleeping. So, you know, there's a lot of and some of it may not be formally recognized, but there is, you know, a good amount of harm out there associated with caffeine. So it's not without its harms. So, you know, and you could, depending on your perspective, given all the medical applications, I mean, you could see cannabis sort of in that middle ground too. And a lot of those really just depend on who you are and the way you're using it. You could make the case for, you know, other drugs, you know, too, you know, if someone using really any of these pharmacological classes in the right circumstances with the right person, you know, the risk profile may be dramatically different.
That's all that's a real core question, the individual differences thing. You know, you talked about, you know, schizophrenics being particularly ill-advised to try hallucinogens. But let me describe a typical person who I know, who, by the way, I told was going to be, you guys were going to be on the show. And I'm going to describe him to you. He is an anxiety-prone person, has sleep issues. He's a highly productive, brilliant guy who's got a very kind, empathic guy already. He's not like he needs drugs to be empathic. He's a sweetheart. And he is a vice president at a Silicon Valley company. And he's a meditator as an attempt to deal with his anxiety. And it has only some success. And he's toying with the idea of macro doses as well as micro doses of acid to address his anxiety and perhaps just enlighten him in broader ways. What would you say to this guy, either, and I'd like to hear both of your answers on this, what would you recommend, if you were the doctor, if you will, recommend, what would you say, and he's healthy otherwise, he's in his early 40s, what would you, or in his 30s, I think he's in his 30s, like the late 30s, what would be the advice you'd give this guy?
I can start. I think the first thing that I would ask is about lifestyle choices, and this is something I've dealt with as an entrepreneur is burnout, particularly adrenal burnout, which can often lead to issues with sleep and anxiety. So sometimes it's less about, hey, microdosing or higher doses might be this kind of magic fix or transformation, and it's much more about how could microdosing or macrodosing be used to help catalyze an understanding that reframing our lifestyle so we're not so working ourselves to the bone, and instead we find balance in other ways can then help to contribute to more holistic wellness.
Yeah, I'm going to push back. He's not a workaholic. He's got a kid. He's very family. He works, you know, he works not crazy hours. Like some people are predisposed to being anxious. Others are laid back. He's a just constitutionally an anxious guy by nature.
Right, and so continuing to be aware of that, and to, if he is going to try these, to start with lower doses to see if that, you know, does something to his anxiety. It may enhance it, but it may also help it. We've heard stories from both angles, and then with higher doses, I mean, Matt can speak more to the medical efficacy of higher doses for anxiety, but it also is looking like those have proven to be effective at helping to reduce anxiety. In particular, they've done research at NYU and Johns Hopkins about end-of-life anxiety. Okay. But Matt can probably speak more to some of the medical elements.
To help people clarify, so I want to let you know, you're just listening to Paul Austin. He runs a website called Third Wave, which is helping people who want to try to use hallucinogens of a variety of sorts, but mainly LSD or psilocybin mushrooms, as something to enhance their work life, but also their life more broadly. And then I am also talking with Matt Johnson, who is Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at Johns Hopkins. So, Matt, what would you tell this guy?
Well, maybe I need to step up and play my role as the skeptic here and say, okay, if it's not legal, I'm not encouraging any use.
Right.
But let's pretend maybe the question is whether he's considering entering a trial where this would be legal.
Okay, good.
So in that case, I would say, you know, there's good evidence that that anti-anxiety effects are very promising. It's very promising data in the trial that we ran that Paul mentioned in cancer patients there. So we need to expand the research, but it's very plausible. So it might be worth trying if you can find that trial.
Well, you know what? That brings us an important point. Now, the legality. How big is the risk? I mean, I got to tell you, right around the corner from my house, I know there's a drug house, and I take my dog around the block for a walk every night, like around midnight. And I see people pulling up for about 2 minutes in front of this house, going in and then coming out. You know, how likely is it that if my friend, who, you know, who is a very responsible person, extremely, how should, if he were to I'm not supposed to, I guess I don't know if I'm supposed to or not, but if he were to try to be reasonably close, say he's not in a trial, but he wants to try it, how could he reduce his risk in terms of dosage purity, legality, getting caught? What are these really realistic risks? What either of you, you know, Matt or Paul, what do you want to tell this guy in terms of that kind of risk?
Well, I think the first option is there are a lot of countries where it's legal, where people do legal ceremonies. And so that's always the first option, is if you can do it in a legal context, do it with the help of guides and professionals in places like Brazil or Peru or Costa Rica or the Netherlands. But beyond that, if it's just at home, you know, a lot of people who are in a similar situation as the friend you described will often use the dark web. And the risks, well, definitely the riskiest thing about microdosing is the illegality of it, from my opinion. Historically, the drug war has been largely about persecuting minorities. And so when you have something like microdosing, which is being used by middle to upper class, largely white individuals, there doesn't seem to be a lot of prosecution or really any litigation so far that I know of related to people who are trying to microdose and finding doing so with illicit substances.
What about, you know, there's drug testing in many workplaces. How likely is acid or mushrooms of some sort to show up in a random drug test, whether it be urine or a hair test?
It'll show up in a hair test, both LSD and psilocybin. They can show up in urine tests, but I can tell you that the common urine tests use, those aren't the drugs they're looking for. I can't tell you how prevalent hair tests are. And that would go back about 90 days, so those are pretty powerful tests, the hair test.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move to summary. Like right now, I've tried to cover a fair degree of ground. I like to end with kind of a catch-all question for each of you. And I start with you, Paul, so why don't I start with Matt, you first. Thing, you know, every single guest who's ever appeared on this show ends up emailing me or calling me. I've said, oh, damn, I wish I had said X. So now you've got your shot. Think about what we've discussed. What is the one thing you either want to say that you haven't yet said, or something you want to underscore about the use of microdosing of either LSD or psilocybin magic mushrooms in terms of a work enhancer, work product or work process enhancer?
We need to look at it. These are serious questions. The data on macrodosing is absolutely astounding. It's cutting-edge medicine. It's transforming psychiatry, in my opinion. If microdosing is anywhere, you know, close to, you know, that level, we need to explore it. We need to explore these compounds inside and out cautiously, but it's all of this is plausible, and we need to throw some real science at it.
Before I turn to Paul, I mean, that's too provocative. I mean, I rarely hear words in terms of behavioral change, in terms of, you know, mind-blowing or transformational or radical transforming psychiatry. Tell us a little bit about what the recent solid research on macro doses of LSD are telling us. It's making the field of psychiatry change so dramatically.
The paradigm shift is we're really talking about medication-facilitated psychotherapy. One pill, you know, that leads to a six-hour experience can dramatically drop anxiety and depression in a cancer patient that's suffering from it. And those reductions look virtually, you know, they stay completely stable for about 6 months. And it's in earlier stages of research, but we're seeing very promising results for straight-up depression and for addictions like cigarette smoking, alcoholism. You just don't see that anywhere else, that for a single medication to occasion a single experience that has a life-transforming effect.
Wow. You know, forgive the pun, but that's pretty mind-blowing. Paul, you get the last word. What's something that you either haven't said and you say, yeah, I want to make sure that our listeners hear this, or something you want to underscore that you have already said?
Yeah, I think the thing to really reemphasize is that microdosing is not a magic pill, and that it's one tool in a larger toolkit of other practices that we use to really be well from, you know, optimally well. And so, you know, microdosing is a tool that can be used. It should be done so in a responsible way. It should be done so, if someone is going to do it, starting very low and incrementally increasing to calibrate, but that it's not the only thing. To look at sleep, to look at diet, to look at exercise, meditation, yoga, these are all other modalities that can help to facilitate creativity, that can help to facilitate focus and presence in the workplace. And I think that's something that's really important to understand.
And I really appreciate both of your presence here on Work with Marty Nemco. Matt Johnson, Associate Professor of Medicine and Behavioral Science at Johns Hopkins, and Paul Austin, the author of the book Microdosing Psychedelics, and the website that he runs is thethirdwave.com. Thank you very much both for being my guests on Work with Marty Nemco.
My pleasure.
Take care, guys.
Thank you, Marty.
Right. Watch
Take
your
care.
Watch your dosages. Take care. All right. And now, my dear listeners, we turn to you. As always, I like to discuss, you know, cutting edge, larger issues very often in the first half of the show. But I am well aware that all of that can seem out of touch with your reality as an individual as you face your work-life problems. And so my priority one in segment two of the show is you. So if you have a work-related problem of any sort, whether you're 16 or 76, unemployed or a very senior successful employees, government, for-profit, non-profit, I do what I call workovers here. This is my last show of my 29th year. Start my 30th year next week. I love doing it, and it's my pro bono work, and I'd love to help you if you've got a work problem. The phone number for what I call a workover is, and here it's at KALW, it's free, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I want to talk about a group that is having a hell of a time, even in this period of unprecedented low unemployment rate, lowest rate in 49 years, and that's being older. Being older can still be one, two, even three strikes against you. Quietly, you know, people may be whispering, he's deadwood. We need fresh blood. Well, sometimes it's obvious they're putting you out to pasture. You're given less important tasks, or your budget's cut, or you're left out of key meetings, or the signs can be subtler. For example, at meetings, the people rarely agree with your suggestion or even ask you a follow-up question. You're irrelevant. Even in the break room, they kind of don't sit next to you. They let alone welcome you into their frivolity. They're fooling around, having a great time, and they don't want to see the Mr. or Ms. Gray Hair. Well, I've got to have assembled a bunch of tips that may help you avoid striking out and maybe even help you hit some home runs. I want to focus first on tips for people on the job. Then I'm going to talk about people looking for new work. Might one of these work for you? Try to get branded as a wise elder. For example, you might offer to mentor young employees or new older ones. Or at a meeting, you could say things like, You know, I ran into a similar situation a number of years ago. We tried X and we tried Y, but both of those failed. But Z worked well. That's a nice way to brand yourself as a wise elder, where everybody at the meeting ends up seeing it. And, you know, to boost your chances of coming up with such goodies, when you receive the agenda for an upcoming meeting, try to spend a little time thinking of such ideas that you could bring up. That effort to brand you as a wise elder, it's never as good when you do it yourself. But if you can get a younger champion, someone who's respected, maybe some up-and-comer who likes you, maybe he or she could recommend you to, say, run some central project, or at least be an advisor on some central project. Or at meetings, again, that person might ask you, you know, Joe, for example, you've seen so much. What's your thought on what's wise to do here? Another thing you might do to help you get branded as a wise elder is see if you can get your job description changed so you're paid more on that acquired wisdom than on how much you crank out. For example, could you angle for a promotion to management? Or informally do process development, or assist employees or customers in solving problems. Those are things where you're not just a work machine, which you may not have the drive or energy to do, but where your those years of accumulated knowledge and wisdom could be really helpful. Another way to succeed on the job when you're older is to really take a hard look at yourself and ask yourself, do you need to upskill? Because the truth is that some of the antipathy toward older people is based in substance. Many older people aren't, for example, technologically up to snuff, or they may learn slowly. Is it time for you to learn something key to your job, or what your job could be? Like, should you take a high-efficiency approach to learning, but going slow and steady if you are not learning as quickly? Should you, for example, self-study the computer software that your company just adopted? Maybe getting a tutor to help you over the rough spots? Or should you take a highly rated, practical, short online course that is what they call asynchronous? So it's not going super fast where you may fall behind if you're not learning as quickly, but many of those are asynchronous where you can go at your own pace, and there's so many good ones on LinkedIn Learning. These are platforms. LinkedIn Learning offers thousands of such courses. Udemy, U-D-E-M-Y, offers thousands. Udacity for tech courses offers tons of them. Or in-person courses. There are some people who derive a lot of energy from being in a live classroom. For example, I'm a big fan of local colleges' extension programs. Whether, you know, we're fortunate here, UC Berkeley's got a world-class extension program. I might say I'm being asked to teach a course or give a public lecture that's free for UC Berkeley Extension on the 30th of October on people who want to change careers. So, I would be saying that no matter what. I am a real believer in college extension programs. San Francisco State has one. UC Santa Cruz has one. Cal State East Bay, I believe, even has one. Extension programs are great, and they're not cheap, but they're affordable. Another tip that's critical for people on the job when they're older: should you shut up? You don't want to exemplify the stereotype that older people are long-winded. When you're speaking, you've got to practice what I've said so many times on the show, the traffic light rule. During the first 30 seconds of an utterance, your light's green. For the next 30 seconds of an utterance, it's yellow. The chances are increasing that you'd stop talking already. At the 60-second mark, your light's red. Unless you're telling a clearly interesting anecdote or explaining something that truly requires a bit more than a minute, shut up or ask a question. Another key to avoiding being seen as long-winded is, if you're in a two-person conversation, talk no more than half the time. Probably 25 to 50% is about right. And finally, a final tip for older people succeeding on the job is recognizing that everyone, but especially older people, have times of the day when they're more productive and times of the day they're less productive. Typically, morning, especially early morning, might be a productive time, and mid-afternoon less so. And if you need to be productive at that point, see if you can do one of those power naps. Escape to your, either you can close your office door or escape to the car and take 20 minutes. Or have a Diet Coke or have that aforementioned caffeine. Can be really valuable. And save your difficult, important tasks for your most productive time. Oh, one more tip I want to give you about older people succeeding on the job. We've probably heard, if you're over 40 or certainly over 50 or over 60, you've heard the term CRS. a lot of older people lament that their memory isn't quite what it used to be. The term CRS is kind of common. Can't remember, because it's the radio I have to say, can't remember stuff. That's become a cliche. Well, it helps to regularly use your phone's voice memo feature or an old-fashioned memo pad, a paper memo pad, to jot down the things you might forget. And importantly, keep looking at it, because you can jot them down. If you don't look at it, it's not going to do any good. So anyway, so those are some tips on succeeding on the job if you're an older person. I want to give some tips for people who are looking for new work in a moment, but I'd like to invite you to call. If you have a question about your work life, especially if you're older, if you're over 40, over 50, over 60, even over 70. My dad worked until he was 82 and would have worked longer, except that the guy he worked for closed up his business. So whatever your age, but especially if you're older, because that's what I'm focusing on this particular segment, if you have a question about your work life, any aspect, whether you're looking for a new job, trying to be more successful in the current job, have lost your motivation, lost your energy, having a problem with a boss or a coworker, have a self-employment idea you want to run by me, I'll play Shark Tank with you, except I'm not as mean as Kevin O'Leary. All those are good reasons to call for work over the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, as I promised, I'm going to share some thoughts about older people who are looking for new work. Please don't make your applications for jobs deceptive. Do not try to hide your age in your resume and in your cover letter. Sure, it might land you the interview, but as soon as they see that you're older than your application implies, they're going to feel deceived. And so they're going to be unlikely to hire you. Create a solid resume and LinkedIn profile. Create a good cover letter. And especially, try to get people to refer you for jobs. That often is enough to land you an interview without your having to try to claw your way out of the hole you created for yourself with a deceptive application. I got a lot more, but I want to go back to the phones, but I'll first get out the phone number. If you've got a work-related problem of any sort, but especially if you're older, because that's what I'm focusing on now, problems of older people either in the workplace or in landing a job, or in starting a business, those are great reasons to call for a work over here on Work with Marty Nemco and KALW. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
I hear you very well.
Okay. I'm in the car.
I know.
So I'm a sales rep, and I feel like I have to fire on a lot of different, fronts in terms of keeping track of the numbers and keeping track of all the different, contacts that might be, using my product.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be 60 next year, and I'm constantly exhausted, and I constantly feel like I'm behind the eight ball and I'm not doing anything well. And so, I just feel like I should be doing something else.
Great. Well, I have two things to talk about, your current job and then going beyond that. First of all, do you use a contact tracker? There is excellent free and low-cost contact trackers, and of course Salesforce if you're working for a large company. Do you use a contact tracker so that you're not forgetting about what you need to do with each of your customers? Let's start with that.
Well, we use Salesforce, which is very cumbersome.
Right.
And takes a lot of time to put everything in. So, no, I don't use Salesforce. I just use my basic Outlook calendar to track things. But now I use Excel spreadsheet, and I'm just putting everything on a spreadsheet.
Right. That's normally not a bit. Now, spreadsheets are also a little awkward. There are really free and easy contact trackers for sales contracts that are, it's like a customized version of an Excel spreadsheet that it may be easier to use than a spreadsheet. Or if you're happy with the spreadsheet, first of all, are you happy with the spreadsheet? Let's start with that.
It's okay. No, I'd like something better. I'd like a free contact management software, but I haven't researched it.
It couldn't be easier. Why don't you just Google contact trackers sales when you get home? Though, these are apps that could be on your iPhone, and just the ones that have lots of 4.5 stars or better and lots of those reviews is something that's worth trying. It'll cost you nothing, or $4.99 or something ridiculous. So why not? And aim for ease. If you're overwhelmed, aim for ease and aim for something that's going to be well-suited to your job. So that could be one way to keep from being overwhelmed. The other thing that good salespeople do is They really do triage their sales contacts. They have their A clients who are high profit margin. In other words, you don't put that much work in, or even if you have to put a lot of work in, you make so much money from them that you love them and you really make sure you're going to spend your time disproportionately with them. Then there are your B clients, who are your average ones. And then there are C clients who either produce very little revenue or are very high maintenance and are very causing you a lot of stress or whatever. And people who are overwhelmed as salespeople just kind of either let their C clients go or give them minimal service. Do you do a good enough job of triaging your clients into A clients, B clients, and C clients?
No. I mean, I have to call on certain dealers as my responsibility, and then I can call on architects, and those are really long shots if they ever specify you, and then I'm supposed to be calling on end users. I'm compensated at a slightly higher rate if I self-direct, if I find the opportunity myself, but I have no time or bandwidth to do that.
So it sounds like, given that you're overwhelmed, for now at least, forget about the damn architects. Forget about the end users. And really triage your, you know, if there's this list of everybody you've got to contact, doesn't mean you have to give equal time to them or need to contact them as frequently. Be very careful. Don't treat, you know, there's a tendency for many people to want to treat all customers equally. But successful people, including any kind of managers, are extremely careful with their time. And they spend their time where it's going to do the most good. I'm going to be speaking with John Chambers, who was named by 2020 as America's Best Boss, Cisco's CEO, next week on the show. And both what he writes and what I've read, and I interviewed Jack Welch, GE's famous CEO, they all say they allocate their time where it's going to make the biggest difference. You've got to, especially if you're overwhelmed, you've got to make sure that you're not spending the same amount of time with everybody, but prioritizing those that will, A, bring in the most money, and B, just maybe who you like and are least stressful. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. You're encouraging me to get a contact tracker to simplify my life.
Two things, contact tracker and being very careful about how you spend your time with your different clients. But you were implying that you were kind of almost done with this job. Were you also calling because you were hoping to get a fresh idea about what you should be doing, or no? Are you really just focusing on how to get control over this job?
Thank you for asking. I actually have the opportunity to do a project as a contractor that I have done that kind of work before, mm-hmm. and it would be, you know, an hourly basis for a project that's going to go on a couple of years and maybe just 30 hours a week instead of 40. And, you know, as a contractor, it would be a higher hourly and I would pay all my own benefits, which I've done before. But, it seems like it'd be easier, but then in a couple of years, I'm going to have to find new work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah.
Is there a difference in terms of, forgive me for sounding, sanctimonious, is there an ethic, do you feel like either one would be more of a calling, either because you're better suited for it or because you believe more in the product or service?
You know, that's a good question, because I feel like my heart isn't in the sales, and like I made a couple screw-ups recently and I felt like, God, I'm letting the people who have their heart in this business and they're making a living to support their family, I feel like, gosh, you know, I'm doing them a disservice because I'm not 100% in it because, you know, it's just so overwhelming. And so it's just easier to do one project and see it through to the end. But the scary part is then you have to find more work.
Well, I would, and you believe in that project you'd be doing, do you believe that it would utilize your skills better? Do you believe you'd be making more of a difference? Overall, would the commute be easier? Tell me about the pros and cons, because, you know, if that job overall is better, you know, 2 or 3 years is an awful long time to build relationships, to convert that project into another project. If you're really burned out on this one, this job, and really don't feel good about it, and you're 60, it's not like you're 20. I would, you know, if you got a two or three good years working on this other job, I think I'd be more inclined to go that, but use your fear that it might go away after 2 or 3 years to either motivate you to see if you could turn it into another contract or another project, or build your network so that you could get another good job afterwards. But the idea, if you're my sister and you're telling me at 60 you're kind of done with this job and really stressed out and overwhelmed and making mistakes and you don't really believe in the product that much, I sure as hell would be encouraging you to make a shift.
Okay.
How do you feel when I say that to you? As a human being, how do you feel as you listen to me say that to you?
You know, it's scary because the truth is I want to retire. Mm. I have a kid in 2 more years in high school, and then I just want to go do my artist thing.
Uh-huh.
I'm like tired of the grind.
Well, if you are, then doesn't that make it your choice even easier? Because then, you know, you've got a job you kind of hate, and you've got this job that's being offered to you with 30 hours instead of 40 hours, and it's 2 to 3 years. Maybe, you know, that's going to take you through your kid's high school graduation, and if you can't find other work or don't want to find other work, you were thinking about retiring anyway. You're making my job easier. It sounds like you should take this other job. Is that wrong?
I don't know. I'm just scared to try to make another move at my age. I'm like, when you talk about the older employee, I'm like, oh my God, that's me. You know, everything is just more of an effort.
Uh-huh. So what could we do to, let's pretend you were taking this job, this other job. We want you to succeed at it. We don't want you overwhelmed at it. Is there some learning? Why don't you tell me a little bit about the contract that you'd be doing? What would be the work you would be doing? And what's making you scared about that? Other than that 3 years from now, you'll need to look for something else. Is there anything that's scaring you about the job itself?
That's a good question. I would just have to be more accountable for one particular project, you know, and be more exacting on one particular, you know, It's all about furniture, you know. It's a project that needs to be outfitted and followed through and deal with all the end users and stuff. Whereas now, you know, I'm rarely in front of the end users, and my job is actually pretty easy because no one's breathing down my neck. This would be more project accountable.
And so, what's the fear? Is the fear that you would, you know, you've got one customer, so you're not going to lose track of things. What's the fear?
That's a good question. Just being a contractor and letting go of my, you know, benefits and whatnot.
I'm not buying it. I'll tell you why, and I'll give you one more reason why I'm not buying it. If you're not doing that well in your current job, you could have benefits or whatever, but they could fire you tomorrow. You know, if you're not productive, you know, and you're 60, then, you know, they say, you know, we got somebody else, or, you know, you're not needed anymore. So job security is illusory now, unless you're working for the government or you're a tenured professor. But you don't have any of that. And if you're screwing up, you know, I don't think, you know, that job security is you're giving it too much weight. I think if you've in this other 30-hour week contract job, if there is something you're afraid you're not going to do very well, then either get skilled at it if you can, or just say, you know, damn it, I'm going to be really focused on being great at customer service. You said you hadn't had experience with the end user for a while. Decide that you're going to be treating every customer like it was your sister and really be awesome with them. And then, you know, you will, A, either that 2 to 3 year contract will extend, or you're going to get such an awesome recommendation either from your end users or your boss at this 30-hour job that if you didn't want to retire, you'd be able to find another job. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And so, okay, you've inspired me because I really need to put a proposal together for the woman who offered it to me, the architect.
Uh-huh.
And I am going to the city tomorrow, so I should put a proposal together because she said, you know, let me know what you would want.
Focus on what you would give, not just what you'd want. Craft the job, the proposal, the job description to accentuate your strengths. So in other words, if you're really good at you say you're an artist type. So if your real strength is in designing the covers of the sofas or the room design or decoration or whatever it is, build more of that to the extent that it's realistically possible. Build that into the job description. Focus on what the architect needs and wants, but there's always very subtle shifts you can make in the job description which will increase your chances of being successful at it And then after you've done that, then your ask for money or whatever is going to be more justifiable, because you're really proposing something that's going to give your best as well as what the architect wants. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I've done this job before. I've worked as an end user before. It's a different project for the same institution. So that's why she's interested in me, because I know this end user. Okay, so that's good. I appreciate that. Yeah. I'll put something together tonight.
If it's one end user, again, the notion is, and I swear to you I do this, I've had 5,500 clients as a career counselor. I treat everyone like it is my brother or a sister. I realize their life is in the balance, and even if it's furniture, people's happiness is so contingent on whether they like the room that they're in, they like the environment. Treat that end user, there's only one, treat her like your sister. And if you focus that and not saying, how can I do the least work possible, you'll be more successful and you'll develop a wonderful relationship with that end user and all will be hunky-dory. What do you think?
Right, and I can get more work from them. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. All right. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye. Sometimes we do 2 or 3 minute workovers and sometimes we take 15. I have time for one more. If you want me to help you with your work problem, whatever it is, especially if you're an older worker, I've been trying to give tips for older workers. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I went to the phones, I was offering tips for people looking for new work. I want to offer some more. I have calls coming in, but I have time for... I guess I don't. Let me just go right back. Let's go right back to the phones. Yeah. Okay. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi. I have a job.
You're echoing. Can you turn down your radio, please?
Yep.
Thank
Sorry.
You. Very good. Go ahead.
I have a job. I've been there 2 months. My boss doesn't seem to like me. Everything I do pisses her off. Mm. My daughter has mental illness, and I'm a single parent. Mm. So in the beginning of the job, there were some issues with me having to take some time off. And so now I thought it would straighten itself out if I straightened my act out, but it seems like it's not getting better. And I don't know if I should try to talk to her and clear the air or just look for another position.
Okay, let's look at that. So sometimes it's the old saying, you never get a second chance to make a first impression, and because of that, you're needing to have taken time off, and maybe you screwed up a bit in the beginning. You can't, you know, your reputation is cast in stone. As somebody I've worked for before, who I made a joke, and he took it the wrong way, and over the years, it seemed like we went downhill from there. I couldn't undo this bad first impression. So sometimes it's that. But sometimes it is that there are screw-ups that you either could fix, or if in your heart of hearts, if the goddess within you says it's not fixable, you should look for another job. So is it, which of those three is it? Is it that you've made a bad first impression and we need to figure out how to press reset with this person? Are you still screwing up and can it be fixed? Or would the goddess within you say you need to look elsewhere?
I think I need to look elsewhere because at this point it's kind of disrespectful.
Okay, and if you feel that's unfit, you know, sometimes a meeting in which you sometimes a meeting of the minds and hearts, you know, over coffee or a drink or whatever can help. But if you feel, let's assume for the moment that you're right, your intuition is it's insoluble. So, do you know what kind of work you'd want to look for?
Yeah, I'll look for the same similar work.
What kind of work is that?
I work in public policy.
Okay, in what kind of a role? Where is your particular? Public policy is much broader than people realize. There is anybody who writes legislation, to background researchers, to people who are fundraisers, to people who are schmoozers and friend makers, on Capitol Hill or in Sacramento. Where is your expertise? And in a certain field, is it environment? Is it health? Is it poverty? Where is your expertise?
My expertise is in poverty, but what I've wanted to do for a long time, but I don't have the skill set for. It's data visualization for policy.
Wonderful. Okay. So if I said don't quit yet if you need the money, and There is an infinite number of these online courses that are cheap to learn some data visualization. Make that your hobby. Instead of, you know, maybe cut back some of your TV or social life or whatever. Or even, you know, make sure you, you know, I know you've got a mentally ill child, but focus on quality care rather than quantity time. And learn enough data visualization so that you could create a little portfolio on a template website you'd make for yourself, and then try to shop that around at least as part of your toolkit that you would sell as a public policy person. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I guess my question was also, if I tried to initiate a conversation, would I be talking myself out of my job?
Well, you might be. Depends on how you do it. So the standard model, and you tell me if this would work well for you, is, let's say this person's name is Mary. So you'd say, Mary, could we get a cup of coffee together? There's something important I wanted to chat with you about. And you say, Mary, you know, I feel I've gotten on to a terrible start with you. First, I took all this time off to take care of my daughter, and then I've made a couple of these screw-ups, and you're understandably annoyed with me. But I really want to do this job well, and I want to give it the good college try. What advice do you have for me as to how I could kind of press reset with our relationship and our work together? What would you like to see me do so that I am more successful at it? So that way you're not placing any blame on her. You're not saying you want to quit. You're being a very constructive employee, and there's relatively little risk that that's going to result in you losing your job. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I feel like I did that. When she talked to me, when she confronted me initially, I told her that I took total responsibility, and I wanted to make sure that she knew that it wasn't a sign of disrespect. And then I have had my daughter hospitalized, and so I had to take some other time. So she has sent me emails that I can be fired, and it's an at-will position.
Well, almost all positions functionally are. By the way,
yes.
You know, is there? Do you have any realistic basis for reassurance that your daughter will not, you will not need to take as much time off in the future, or is that not realistic to say?
No, it's not realistic.
I see. So is it possible, right? So, you know, and this job sounds like it requires you to be there all the time.
It doesn't. That's the thing. We're not that busy. I feel like she's
okay.
And I've only mentioned seizures. I haven't mentioned mental illness because parents tend to be a little judgy.
Okay. So. Let me, because the show is almost over. So I would say, you know, if you could then say to her, I'm hoping that we could make this work because I really like this job for these reasons. And I'm wondering if, given the variable workload that I have, I'm wondering if there is a way we can work things out so that you're not as unhappy with me when I have to take time off, either in what I do when I'm here or whatever. So you present it like you're on the same side of the table trying to solve problems together. Is that hopeless, or is that something you want to try?
No, I mean, I want to try. She asked me to give her a proposed alternative schedule, and I did 3 weeks ago. She hasn't addressed it at all. And so this is why I'm starting to feel like disrespected, and then the whole thing kind of goes down the tubes because
I got to stop you because we got to forget about the respect thing. I would gently follow up and say, you know, I wanted to follow up with you about the proposal. Do you think it's a good idea or not? And how else can we make things work? And then quietly, if you're not getting good reactions from her, then do the kind of looking for something else that I said. Anyway, thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. I will talk with John Chambers, former CEO at Cisco, who 2020 called America's best boss, and who Time Magazine named one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.